The company behind the Power and Light District, Cordish Company, has recently gotten abatements on a new housing development in the historic Midland building downtown, featuring what they call an affordable housing option, a micro apartment which they plan to rent at $700 to $750 a month for around 315 square feet of space. 315 square feet. Can you picture that? It is not a lot of space, certainly not by Kansas City standards where we're accustomed to spreading out, and not for families with kids or elders to care for. So the question this has sparked is, who are these apartments really for? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're talking micro apartments. What's the theory behind this model for keeping some downtown housing affordable? And why are so many people so skeptical? My guests are development commentator Kevin Collison, who writes for KCUR.org and his own blog, City Scene KC, and Tara Raghuveer, an advocate for affordable housing in Kansas City. She's been studying eviction in Kansas City for years, and she's the director of KC Tenants, a group that opposes the deal. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning.
Hi, Tara.
Hey, Gina.
So, Kevin, let's start with what a micro apartment is.
Well, a micro apartment is a trend in apartments all over the United States, where you're certainly not unique in Kansas City. It's a way to try to provide housing that's more affordable for single people. I mean, it is not intended to be for a family. It might be for a very cozy couple, but it is something that happens on the coast, Minneapolis, Denver, you name it, and now it's being introduced to Kansas City as one way.
And specifically for affordability?
Well, yes, it's one way for a developer to be able to provide a place that an individual could live for a, you know, what some people consider, many people consider affordable rent.
Is this just a new name for a studio apartment?
They are smaller than your typical studio apartment. Studio apartments.
For a small studio apartment.
Yes, it is it's definitely the same thing as a studio, but it's just a smaller footprint.
Why is it such a buzzword?
Well, you know, in Kansas City, it seems like anytime we get change, people somehow think that we're the first person to be affected by all this. The term has not been used around here up until recently, although this is definitely not the first project to introduce what you'd call micro apartments into the downtown market anyway. The Pickwick renovation project of the old Pickwick building introduced units as small as 353 square feet. There's a developer that just opened up a project on 52nd and Troost called Scholars Row. Some of those units are as small as 300 square feet. So it's something relatively new to our market. The Midland project, of course, gets tied into some of the controversy that automatically seems to go along with Cordish whenever they do anything downtown. But it's certainly something that's been going on all over the United States, particularly in major markets like New York and Chicago and LA and San Francisco.
Do you think that there is something to the idea that in Kansas City, historically, at least within my lifetime memory, cost and space seem to be pretty, like, directly proportional in a lot of people's minds, like an expensive place is a big house. You know what I mean?
I
hear
what you're
saying. For a long time in Kansas City, that has been...
Oh, Kansas City's been a very affordable place for a long, long time. But, you know, one thing, I was actually on the phone this morning with a historic architect here in town who was very knowledgeable, and she pointed out that, in a way, this is the 21st century version of what they used to call a boarding house back in the, you know, the 40s and the 50s, when a young person who needed a place to stay would rent a room and share a bathroom down the hall with somebody, and they'd have a common area down in the parlor, whatever. I mean, every generation, I think, encounters these kinds of issues. This is happens to be the solution right now that developers are coming up with to try to provide that option for people.
So in other cities, though, I do understand that micro apartments can actually be even smaller than this. They can closer to 200 square feet.
You go out to IKEA, for example, and they actually have showroom spaces that show you what a 230 square foot place could look like, you know, if you furnish it totally in IKEA gear. But, you know, it's definitely something that there are even smaller ones in places like New York and San Francisco and Seattle.
In Cordish, they have gotten tax abatements for this project, right?
They got abatements for the project, yes. That was part of the whole deal.
Is that because of the fact that they've included this option as an affordable option?
It's certainly a part of it, yes. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, it's a historic building. The Midland is an old office building. I think it opened up in the 1930s. And it's been empty for about 10 years or so. And it was part of the overall redevelopment plan for the Power and Light District. And yes, Cordish is getting property tax abatements for it.
So, you know, 300 square feet is pretty tiny, and not everyone is sold on this plan, in part because of who needs affordable housing and whether this actually serves them, but for other reasons, as you've mentioned. And the newly formed group, KC Tenants, protested the deal outside the building. Let's give a little listen to that protest.
This project is a shameful reflection of this city's priorities. This particular deal with Cordish may be done, but this city belongs to us.
So, Tara Raghuveer, what is this all about? When you hear that clip, what is it that people may not understand about what they're hearing?
So that was our leader, Tiana Caldwell. She's fierce. I think she's been on this show back in December. She lived homeless for 6 months after she was evicted after her most recent diagnosis with ovarian cancer. And Tiana is one of the most incredible leaders in our base who recognizes that, of course, she's not alone. She's a working mother. She and her husband both work. They have a young son named AJ. And they're among around 9,000 people a year who are being evicted in this city. That's about 42 per business day. And I think it was good for Kevin to mention at the very outset of this segment that when we're talking about micro units downtown, we're talking about housing that was built specifically for single young people. And what Tiana's talking about in that clip is something that we all know, that the demand for truly affordable housing is not among single young people.
Yeah, it's not about a temporary lifestyle choice at a stage in life. It's something
right,
else.
Right. Someone like Tiana, who is representative of many poor and working class families in the city, are actually the people who need affordable housing. And this project is just the recent in a set of decisions that City Hall and developers have made that clearly show who they prioritize, which is single young people over poor and working class families.
When you think about the downtown location specifically, why is it important for there to be downtown housing that's affordable?
We have many members of our base who work downtown, who work in the public library or Union Station, and who want to live close to work. Many of our members who are tenants cost burden because the rents are so high also don't have cars or access to good transit in other neighborhoods. So living downtown is actually a priority for them. And some of them, many of them, are working families. So they can't live in a micro unit with their two or three kids. And they do want to live downtown. I've seen Kevin comment on Twitter that, you know, working families don't want to live there. That's not true when I talk to folks in my base.
Kevin, where do you get the idea that working families don't?
I think almost every city I've ever visited, and I lived in New York for a while, and I've been to Minneapolis, Denver, Kansas City. Most of the time, when people start having children, they want to get a house and they don't want to be living in an apartment. You know, I don't have anything but anecdotal observations there, but I would be very skeptical that there are many families with kids that want to live in a high-rise building in downtown Kansas City.
Tara?
There's a workforce downtown. There are servers, there are people who work in the hotels, there are folks who work at any of the federal buildings or city municipal buildings that we have downtown. Those folks have families, and if they don't have cars especially, of course they want to live downtown. I think the assertion that they don't is just incorrect.
Well, so we may not get an absolute solution to this disagreement, though perhaps when our callers join the conversation at 816-235-2888, we will hear from people who perhaps do need affordable housing, whether downtown housing is something that would appeal to them. That's certainly part of this conversation. So, Tara, why is rent getting to be so high more broadly? We've talked about this before, and it isn't just a Kansas City thing. It's all cities. Last time we talked, you were optimistic that Kansas City still has time to create an ecosystem where you see mixed incomes throughout the city, that's still a possibility. Do you still feel that way? It's been a few months.
Yeah, it's been a few months since I've been back. I remain optimistic. I think, you know, one of the reasons I moved back to Kansas City 4 months ago and started Casey Tenens is that I really feel like there's a possibility that it's not too late for Kansas City. Kansas City does not have to go the way of New York and San Francisco and Denver.
What does too late look like in those cities?
Too late looks like a homeless population that's ballooning and really has no place to go. Too late looks like rents that begin at a floor of something like $750 and only get more ridiculous from there for square footage that could never hold a working family. Too late looks like a whole service industry that still works downtown being displaced further and further out so they can't access any of the city's utilities. And Kansas City's not there yet, and we should be doing everything in our power to keep from getting there. My fear and our fear at Casey Tenens is that projects like this most recent Cordish proposal downtown only perpetuate what is a trend across the country and a trend that's beginning in Kansas City. If we set a new floor for affordability that's over $2 per square foot for a tiny unit downtown, then there will be a massive exodus that frankly is already beginning of people leaving Kansas City, and there's no place for them to go.
There is this question of how we define affordable. And my understanding is that in general, it's about percentage of a household's income and not dollar per square foot. Is that how a small apartment at $700 to $750 gets classified as affordable?
That's right. It's classified as affordable because it's based on area median income downtown. And specifically, this project, I believe, is 80% of area median income downtown. And of course, the median incomes downtown are going to be higher than those on the east side or elsewhere. So the idea of what is affordable there is skewed. And I think points to the flaws that we have nationally and also, of course, locally in measuring what affordable truly actually means for working people.
Kevin, what is the argument for what Cordish is doing and for why the city approved it?
Well, what's interesting is downtown, from what I observe, is being the whipping boy for a larger problem that I totally agree with Tara. Yes, we do need to provide more affordable housing for families. But for some reason, downtown has become kind of the ground zero for the argument, which I think is totally wrong. The whole idea was we want to have a mixed use, or we want to have a range of incomes of folks who can live and work downtown, many of the same service workers that Tara is talking about. These are single people for the most part. And there are neighborhoods close into downtown, Columbus Park, the West Side, Longfellow, that are definitely opportunities for people to be able to find an affordable home. That's where the city's energy should be focused if we're talking about solving housing issues for families. For single people, what they're trying to do with micro apartments is provide that option for the waiter or the clerk or somebody who's not making a lot of money to have a place if they want to live downtown that's a nice, decent place. It's not big, but what they do is they try to give you more attractive common spaces. You're often outside the building, walking around, going to places. That's the kind of lifestyle a lot of people in major urban areas live.
Tara, it sounds like you are making the case that the proximity to work is partly a priority in your mind because of transportation issues in some of the neighborhoods closely surrounding downtown.
That's right. And I want to be clear, I know servers and clerks who have families and do want to live downtown. We also have people in our base who, as Kevin said, don't want to live downtown. And there is an issue with disinvestment in neighborhoods outside of downtown. I think that's why downtown becomes the whipping boy, because people see massive abatements going to companies like Cordish for one light, two light, three light, all of which we had promises made for affordable units within. Those promises were never delivered. So it's not at all confusing to me why downtown becomes a whipping boy, because we've seen it grow and develop and start to prosper at the expense of neighborhoods outside of downtown throughout the city.
And I disagree with that totally. It's not at the expense of the neighborhoods outside downtown. Believe me, if a developer wanted to come along and invest in an apartment project, which is actually happening along Truce these days, the city would provide all kinds of incentives. You have to have the private developer first. People have the misconception that incentives are just cash being handed out to developers to build in downtown. It's not. You have to have somebody willing to invest up front, and then they get the incentives. They get the taxes that would be on the future value of that project returned to them to help make it work financially for them. The neighborhoods, believe me, if somebody came up and there are proposals that are going on with the neighborhoods, that if they had a proposal that made financial sense, the city would give them the maximum incentives possible. So that's a total zero-sum argument that a lot of people are making, that downtown is benefiting at the neighborhood's expense. It's not true.
This is a really complicated issue, and we are going to get back into this aspect of it shortly, because we'll be hearing some both mayoral candidates in Kansas City talking about the bigger picture of the sort of ecosystem around abatements, around developers' investments, et cetera. We're going to hear a little bit about that shortly, and it does revolve around the micro apartments thing. But I want to take a call from Lorenzo. Lorenzo is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Lorenzo.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing good.
What do you want to share?
Well, you know, I just wanted to share, you know, I moved to Kansas City in 1993. So, I don't know a whole lot of the history except, you know, beyond that. But, you know, I've been, you know, homeless here in Kansas City for just over, suffered an eviction 6 months ago, and then just pretty much been homeless, you know, over 6 months ago. And, you know, I sit and I listen to the politicians, you know, talk about crime. I think you guys mentioned on the show earlier, you know, you talk to, politicians addressing crime here in this city. But sometimes when you look at the big picture with people trying to fight this situation of homelessness, you have people who are trying to survive. So when you have properties like this popping up around the city that people can't afford, you know, and you put them in a position where they can't afford, you know, they don't have affordable housing, you know, they're trying to find a place to stay, they're trying to purchase food. So you put them in a position of survival. So now you have a recipe for crime. You know, not that I've gone that way, but I see where I found myself is I'm working more hours just trying to afford rent here in Kansas City. So I'm finding myself trying to work over 40 hours, you know, a week, you know, and with three kids, being a single dad, you know, now, you know, what we define as proper parenting, you know, spending time with your kids and mentoring your kids, I'm finding it challenging to even do that because I'm working so hard and so much, you know, trying to afford, you know, a decent living.
Lorenzo, we've had some debate in this studio about whether downtown is where an apartment downtown is where a family would want to be. Is that someplace that you would mm-hmm. want to be?
You know, with a family, probably not. But when you talk about living downtown, when like I said, I've been here since 93 and I've watched downtown actually grow. And it's grown only because Kansas City wants to look like another city. It's always, they're always competing with wanting to look like a Chicago, a Atlanta, you know, they want to look like, it's always been a debate. Well, other cities have this. Well, other cities is doing this. Well, we're not Chicago. Can we set a trend and do something where we're building properties for, you know, the homeless or people to be able to afford affordable housing instead of trying to compete with or look like some other city?
Well, Lorenzo, thank you for that call. You can call 816-235-2888 to discuss the micro apartment idea. Would you live in 300 some square feet if it meant getting to be in a downtown, desirable, walkable neighborhood? Have you lived in a space that small? And would you do it for $700 to $750? Could you do it at that price? Share your perspective. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about micro apartments, living spaces that are less expensive than existing options in the downtown neighborhood where they're being created because they're smaller. Is this a solution to an affording housing issue, or is it just an option for people in a very specific set of life circumstances? Call 816-235-2888 to join that discussion. Tara Raghuveer, director of KC Tenants, scholar of housing and eviction issues. Welcome back.
Thanks, Gina.
And Kevin Collison of City Scene KC, contributor at kcur.org. Hello again to you, too.
Good to be back.
This micro apartment debacle came up in a listener's question during the mayoral debate on Up to Date yesterday. And I do want to play that part of this discussion. In this clip that you're about to hear, Steve Kraske is asking a question. You'll hear him asking the question, and then you'll hear answers first from Quentin Lucas and then from Jolie Justice.
Another question from our audience, from James. What is your perspective on Cordish Company's proposal to build affordable, quotes around that word, units as small as 315 square feet for as much as $750 a month? And would you live in a micro unit yourself, Councilman Lucas?
No, I don't think I would live in a micro unit. I haven't thought about that, but no. And this is a, you know, and I've been critiqued for this. You know, we have an ordinance in committee right now about percentage affordability inside housing units. I was actually the one who got past our first ordinance that required affordable units to be part of any incentivized housing project. What was the problem? The city had different definitions of affordability. So some apartment builders were saying affordable is $1,600 a month. We got that cut down by $600. That was still way too much. And right now we have an ordinance that frankly I think is still a little too high. And we're trying to make sure we come up with a solution that says both, you need to have units that are at or below a certain number. Right now the ordinance endeavors to have it $800 or below, but there's a size requirement on all those units as well. You can't just have the 300 square foot apartment and then say, well, yeah, it's $700 and that's all good. So my view is no, that's not truly affordable. There's another concern I have with that proposal, and it's the fact that that proposal came out of the Three Light project, and they said, well, we don't want to necessarily build affordable units in our building. We'll just put the affordable units in another separate building. It's like some sort of housing apartheid, and I don't actually think you need such a thing, right? When we say percentage affordability within the building, it is that you have access to the same door, the same amenities, all the same stuff that the taxpayers are subsidizing in a 2-light, a 3-light, a 4-light, a 5-light, as you're getting anywhere else. So I'd like to see them reshape that plan, make it fully mixed income, make you, if they want to do micro units, then I guess they can, but make those market rate micro units and start building truly affordable housing in all of the lights, not just say that there's this separate building over there where we're going to do that sort of thing.
Councilwoman Justice.
You know, I absolutely support many of the programs we have right now to increase affordable housing in this city. And I do not see the project that we are talking about very specifically as addressing those needs. I will tell you that the first and the biggest thing that we can do on affordable housing is making sure that we are taking the now 9,000 vacant and abandoned properties that we have throughout our city, getting them rehabbed and getting people into those homes. Because if I were a young mother, if I were a working family, if I were someone who had a job outside of downtown Kansas City, no, a 300 square foot, $700 unit would not work for me. But if I had just graduated from college and was interested in living downtown and maybe not having a car because my job was downtown, I might consider that. And I think that's an opportunity that should be available, but it can't be the only opportunity.
Okay, so this is interesting. There are a lot of points to unpack here, and I want to start with what we just heard. Jolie Justice saying that this is an important option to have on the table. It just doesn't solve the larger problem, doesn't address a problem of housing affordability. Thoughts, Tara?
Yeah, well, I heard Councilwoman Justice say two things. One, this is not an affordable housing
right.
development. And two, it may work for some people, but it won't work for others. And I think that gets to the point that I've been trying to land the whole time, which is that I think this most recent proposal, like many that we've seen developed by Cordish and by other developers, is a clear reflection of who we are prioritizing in Kansas City and who we are not prioritizing. We very well might need more housing for young folks who are coming out of college and are professionals downtown. We should not be calling that affordable housing. And that, as the priority for our city's housing development, is frankly an embarrassing reflection of our city's priorities when it comes to housing.
Kevin?
Well, I heard Jolie basically reflecting a lot of what I think I've been talking about, and that, you know, this is an option for a certain segment of the market, and that the other big opportunity is all the abandoned and vacant housing we have in close-in neighborhoods to downtown with good transportation access to downtown. And I want to add one thing, because this is something that's really annoyed me throughout this whole debate. For some reason, the federal government and the state government are getting a complete pass on how do we address the affordable housing issue. It all seems to be falling on the shoulders of City Hall. And I just think years ago, there was something called a federal housing authority. That's major priority and responsibility was to develop affordable housing. I have not heard the Kansas City Housing Authority mentioned once in this entire debate. And the state has an obligation. For many years, they had a low-income housing tax credit program that helped to revitalize several big downtown buildings for affordable housing. Again, these are apartments, and again, I believe most families don't want to live in an apartment with young children. However, it was a way—
We might have to take that piece of the argument just out of it,
right,
because we're
right.
not
yeah,
going
we're never
to
gonna prove that one.
At
but
this
anyway,
table, I
anecdotally.
Don't think
but the point is that the state abandon its low housing tax credit program. The feds, because of massive cutbacks in federal funding, and I don't know what the local situation is with the Kansas City Housing Authority, but they have not been at the table in helping to address this problem, which I totally acknowledge is real.
Tara?
Well, I think, Kevin, if you've read anything I've written or anything that Casey Tenets has put out there, we're certainly not passing the blame from the federal government and the state government and focusing only on the local. We have to understand the federal and state context for the housing crisis in Kansas City. But the fact is the Department of Housing and Urban Development has been starved for resources for decades. There's been federal austerity. They've faced cuts year after year, especially in this administration. There's no new money coming for housing programs, leaving us in a context where only one out of every five people in the United States who qualifies for HUD assistance for their housing actually gets it. I just want to correct an assertion. The low-income housing tax credit program has come back in the state of Missouri as of recently. But even all of those programs that exist leave 13,000 people on the waiting list for Section 8 or housing assistance in the Kansas City metro area alone. The inspections for Section 8 have fallen to a place of basically doing nothing at all. And I do want to make the point that the reason that there was such severe disinvestment at the federal and state level is because people started making the argument that the private sector could do it better, which is the same argument that we're now hearing with the development of affordable housing in Kansas City. So I just want to say, I feel like the federal and state failures are a reflection of the same arguments that we're now making for why projects like Cordish's are important, why the other side is making the arguments that the other side, rather, is making about why these projects are important. But that was the same line of logic that led us to the state where we're in right now, where the government has totally failed working families when it comes to housing.
I am. So digging into a little bit of what Quentin Lucas was saying, he mentioned percentage affordability in housing units. Can you explain, Tara, what he's talking about there? That there is, to get tax abatements, a requirement regarding the percentage within the development of units that are affordable, right?
Yeah, my understanding is that his proposal includes a requirement of 15% affordable. But as he acknowledges, the definition of affordable has been extremely fraught in Kansas City and in many other places across the country. So that percentage requirement doesn't mean a lot. And also, as I said before, those requirements have not been met by many of the big developers who have made, who have built projects downtown and otherwise and gotten tax abatements to do so.
And he says if you want to do, if you want to do micro apartments, do it, but put them at market rate. What does that mean?
I'm not sure what exactly he means by that. I mean, to me, $750 for 315 square feet is market rate. That's just
so
not
maybe
anything.
He's saying don't call it something else?
Or? Yeah, I think that's probably a more fair assessment of what he's saying there.
So there's also this argument about addressing vacancy, addressing empty lots, abandoned structures in urban neighborhoods beyond the sort of core of downtown. That is a crucial piece of this puzzle. You've made that argument in the past as well, Tara.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that argument. And that's part of why I think Kansas City has a lot of hope when it comes to the future of housing and the leadership that we could take as a city to solve this problem. But the truth is that building, developing, rehabbing those units, even those vacant units outside of downtown, is not ever going to be truly profitable for developers if we are building those units to be truly affordable to the people who need them. Per my research, the real demand for affordable housing is at sometimes as low as 20% of area median income. And building a project like that is not going to be profitable to the average private developer. But our argument at KC Tenants is that if we're more concerned with the developer's profits than we are truly affordable housing for people, we're missing the point.
Well, of course, that gets back into the whole argument is where is the Kansas City Housing Authority? Where is HUD? Where is the state? I mean, yes, they're going to need subsidies to make these homes affordable to people because developers on their own are obviously there to make a profit. That's how the world works. And I disagree with Tara. Unless the low-income housing tax credit program suddenly quietly got enacted by the state, last time I heard Governor Parsons was thinking about executive authority re-implementing it, but I never read anywhere or heard anywhere that he actually did it. And the legislature certainly took a pass on it this year. But, you know, it gets back into what are we talking about? When we get back to the original subject of micro apartments, I will not deny it all. That's the market they're geared for, is single people who want to live downtown and who want to be in a building that's taking care or take part of the same amenities as the surrounding area. It's not for working families.
Let's take some calls. We'll come back to our debate a little bit before we go, but I do want to get some of these callers' voices in. Let's talk to Drew calling from Olathe. Hi, Drew.
Hey, Gina. I think, you know, the micro housing is a great tool in the toolbox for dealing with the homelessness problem, but I think we as Westerners need to reevaluate how we look at space. When we have houses in these places, we just have a tremendous, we waste space on items that we're not going to use every week necessarily, not the essentials. And I think we should have a community storage option where the community shares a space, they jointly own it. And I also think there's something to be said, and no one's brought this up, now someone can correct me if this exists, why can't we have not-for-profit housing developers to also address this problem?
Tara is nodding vigorously at this one. Tara, is this something that comes up in these conversations?
Absolutely. So as I said before, I think when it comes to housing that will be truly affordable for the people who most need it in Kansas City, I don't think that's going to be provided by developers who are looking to make big profits, frankly. So I think there's a huge role for the nonprofit ecosystem to play and also for the city to play. In many cities across the world, there is something called social housing, which is housing that's provided by nonprofits or by the government, and it's provided at affordable rates. It provides mixed income housing, and much of it is actually beautiful and sustainable. It's good by the environment, and people who live in it love it.
So Drew also mentions that we have a particular concept of space, and I don't think anyone's arguing that 315 square feet is a size of space that is conducive to family living. Like, nobody's making that argument. There is there a stepping back from this? Is there a grain of truth in this idea that we maybe do need to reevaluate our expectations when it comes to space, particularly when we're talking about the urban setting?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, there is certainly among younger people a desire not to have so much stuff, to not have a car, to not have all the things that we thought we needed 50 years ago, 40 years ago, whatever, and that a micro apartment is a place where they can live and not have to be overwhelmed by a lot of material things. And again, if anybody wants to just see a quick example, I mean, it's just fun to go out to IKEA and see how they show how you can design a unit where people can live and it seems to be quite comfortable and you don't have all the trappings that maybe your parents or your grandparents felt they needed.
And this is, though, this is a conversation that pertains to a specific segment
right,
of the population.
Exactly, yeah.
So last Friday, Casey Tenants was actually right next to the proposed development for the Cordish, quote, affordable project. And we had artists perform some street theater and recreate what a 315 square foot unit looks like. And then we moved furniture into that unit. We put a bed, a table, four chairs, and a chaise lounge, and that's it. And it took up the whole space. And there were audible gasps when we arranged that because people realized there was no place for the bathroom. There was no place for a kitchen. And you might be able to miniaturize all those furniture items and make some space for the rest of it. But I think the reality is, I mean, back to what you said before, Gina, micro unit is a sexy buzzword to call a small studio. And it might work for some people. I'm not arguing with that. But the idea that this would be considered the future of affordable housing, I think, is ridiculous.
And nobody's making that argument.
Let's talk to Amy in Prairie Village. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for having me. I had a question for Kevin because I keep hearing all these statements about what people looking to live downtown want and what the demographic is and what young people want these days. And, I mean, anecdotally, none of that rings true to me as a younger person, as a young family. The people that I meet in day-to-day life just don't seem to fit this demographic that he's talking about.
Wait, can you elaborate on that? Describe what you hear from young people that you think contradicts the assertions that you've heard on this show.
Well, I have never heard young people say they don't want stuff. I mean, I haven't heard younger people talking as though they want less things in their life than people of other generations. I just don't really know where that's coming from. And I don't know where it's coming from when he's saying that only single people want to live downtown. And so what I'm wondering is if the city's actually done any research about who needs housing, about who's looking for housing. You know, where are some of these assertions coming from?
About who is out there looking and what it is they want and need.
Right.
Okay, Kevin, what do you know
about that? Well, I'd like to know from the caller, does she know of a couple with a couple of children that want to live in an apartment building in downtown Kansas City? That's just a demographic I do not see or hear about very often.
Amy, do you?
I mean, I know somebody with a baby who does.
Okay.
A baby who will presumably become a child, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, Kevin, what do you know about what research has been done about the demand and the need and the preferences?
Well, I don't have the stats off the top of my head, but I do know that when the Downtown Council, for example, which does try to track who the people are that are living downtown, the overwhelming majority are single folks, are empty nesters. So there are older couples that have downsized, who've sold their house in the suburbs and
but
decided.
But is this one of those things where it's hard to measure who would do it based on the options that are already available and who they're geared toward?
Not quite sure I'm tracking, but it's just, yeah, people who make the conscious choice that they want to live in an apartment in an urban walkable environment. And oftentimes those are either single people or they're couples that are empty nesters.
Tara, thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think those stats reflect who would live downtown or who wants to live downtown.
Well, we are going to agree to disagree going out today, and you can keep talking about all of this on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tara Raghuveer, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina.
Kevin Collison, thank you.
A pleasure.
And up next, we will be lightening the mood on KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now we're talking with James Stutzman of City Barrel Brewing, a brewery releasing a new beer in honor of Father's Day called Dad Jokes. They're also hosting a release party tonight featuring a live Dad Jokes contest. James Stutzman, hello.
Good morning.
What inspired this?
Oh, well, let's see here. Well, I am unfortunately one of those people that make terrible puns that make lots of people roll their eyes,
be ashamed. One of those people, a dad also?
Also a dad, yes.
One of those dad people.
And when we were still under construction before opening the restaurant and brewery, it was one of those days. And my wife's just like, "Oh my God, that was a terrible joke." Then it was brought up. She's like, "Should definitely name a beer dad jokes." I was like, "Yes."
Can you tell me from your perspective what a dad joke is? Like how you would define this particular kind of joke and what sets it apart from other, I don't know, is it fair to say lame jokes?
Let's see here. The genre of dad jokes. Well, they have to be typically short. It doesn't hurt if it has a terrible pun. And
do you have to laugh harder at the joke than anyone else?
I think that's a requirement. Yeah, typically, the best is when the dad joke is so good and so highbrow that you have to explain it because it's so funny.
And then, are corresponding eye rolls also a requirement?
Very much so. Eye rolls, just sheer embarrassment. It's definitely a requirement for a good solid dad joke.
Can non-dads make dad jokes?
Oh, 100%. I'm a firm believer that the whole dad hat thing came around because younger people started making terrible jokes.
Okay, so tell me about the beer. I'm looking at the can. It's got a comic strip sort of encircling it, and it includes a mention on the label that this is well paired with minivans and socks plus sandals.
Yes. So each beer we always have a pairing with it. So one of our beers pairs well with looking good and feeling good, and this beer clearly pairs well with minivans and socks with sandals.
So tell me about the beer itself and how you specifically brewed it to be, can I say, endearingly not funny?
All right. So it's a big Imperial IPA. We call it a hazy IPA. And it's kind of a new style of IPA that's not as bitter, but it's more juicy. So we use these really fun hops called Galaxy and Green Ghost hops. And it gives it just crazy passion fruit, peaches. And it's really citrus forward.
I love that you called them really fun hops.
Yes, they're totally fun. Yes. And the other thing is, obviously, when we made this beer, way where in the kettle, we had to tell the beer terrible jokes. So from the get-go, it was ready to be what it was meant to be.
Are you serious or kidding right now?
I'm a little bit serious.
What jokes did you tell the beer?
Oh, let's see here. So this has been, so again, we're all, two of the three partners, we have kids, and three of the three partners, we make terrible dad jokes. It all started out just that morning when we were getting ready to mix the grain in and get going. It started with a terrible joke. I think, it was a beer joke. So it started out with, one of my partners was like, "Well, I used to hate my beard, but it's really grown on me." And that's how the day started, and it just all went downhill from there.
Since announcing that there's going to be a contest, and that's at the party releasing this beer tonight, you're going to have a live dad jokes contest.
Yes.
So you've said that you can be a non-dad to make dad jokes. Can you be a non-dad to compete in the dad jokes contest?
Absolutely. So basically, the rules are you'll go head-to-head with somebody, and you bring your terrible, amazing dad jokes. The other person will bring their terrible, amazing dad jokes.
So it's plural.
Yes. So bring a list of jokes, and then basically, if you tell a joke and if your opponent laughs, they lose. So we'll do a total of 10 points for laughing, and whoever gets the other person to laugh 10 times wins.
Since announcing the contest, have people been testing out their dad jokes on you?
Oh yeah, it's been fun. So I play softball on Monday nights, and
very on brand.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Old guy sport. There we go. And yes, I had a couple people just getting after it, testing it out, and see if I could laugh.
Okay, can you give you some favorites that you've heard so far?
All right, let's see here. One of my personal favorites is, I ordered a chicken and an egg from Amazon. I'll let you know.
These are jokes that I've realized all inspire the same reaction in me. It's not actual laughing.
Yes.
It's just like an expression of like, I get it.
Yeah, it's one of those, you're a little ashamed, but it still brings you joy.
Yeah, there is some joy in that realization of like, I get it.
Right.
But it's not like, you know, like the gut laughter.
That's oh, when, yeah.
Like, that's not,
oh,
that's
yeah.
not happening.
Correct.
But okay, go on.
All right, another one that's great. So Gina, so how much does a hipster weigh?
I don't know.
About an Instagram.
I can't help it.
Same.
I can't. I'm not going to do that next joke.
I don't believe you, but that's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. Let's see here. So I'm reading a book on the history of glue. I just can't put it down.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about something that really stuck with you.
Let's see here. What's another fun one? Dum-da-dum. All right. There's
you
just
know what?
Too
I was,
many to choose from. That's the
best
part.
Can I just
part.
Tell you something? I was
yes.
reading online about dad jokes yeah. today because it's my job to do things like that. And the intro to one of the think pieces on dad jokes
think
said...
Think pieces. That's,
yeah.
Yeah. That's a stretch.
It is. It said that a joke doesn't have to have a kernel to be corny.
Nice. So I was speaking of think pieces on dad jokes, I was reading an in-depth article, and so it was actually interesting. Did you know that in America, 5 out of 4 people admit that they're bad with fractions?
I won't make that expression, but I get it. I get it, and I'm...
I see your face. It's hurting you. It's hurting you.
So who are you... Are you going to be judging the contest? Who will be judging this contest?
I will be judging, I will be emceeing, and I will be competing all. Basically, the
That sounds nepotastic.
Well, it'll be the people in the audience will tell us if it was a laugh or not, and we'll have a little buzzer.
But so wait, is that the criteria? That is part of what I'm curious about.
Yes.
Because if you're voting on how good the joke is...
No, it's just if you laugh or not. If you're, so for instance.
So you can be laughing at, not with, et cetera.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So it all comes down to, can you hold it in, or is that terrible dad joke going to make you laugh? And if you laugh, the person who told the joke gets a point.
As a dad, though, do you feel a little bit insulted by this moniker of dad joke? Because in a way, it's sort of like, I don't know, it's like saying... I feel like there's some statement in it about a stage of life a person has reached and how relatively cool or not cool it is. And I think being a dad is very cool.
Well, I will say this, as far as a stage in life, I've been telling dad jokes well before having a kid, and I have never once worn socks with sandals. So it doesn't have to be a full-on dad stage. It can be just terrible jokes and terrible puns and lots of eye rolls.
Do you is there a part of you that feels like you're sort of like taking back an identity by embracing the sort of mockery of dad jokes?
Oh, 100%. Whenever my wife came up with the idea for the name, it was not her way of being like nice. It was that's terrible. You make a lot of bad dad jokes. And I'm like, no, I make great dad jokes. Thank you.
Oh, my gosh. I love that. And so... As Father's Day rolls around, I mean, do you see this as an expression of pride about the stage of life you're in, your role in the family?
100%. It's a lot of fun. And it's really fun to be able to talk to other people about how much people enjoy these terrible, delightful jokes.
And so are they really bad, though, if people are getting joy from them?
I look at it like this. Although you're asking me... And not the people that I make these terrible jokes to. So I think, yes, if they make you laugh, then the world's a better place. If it makes you laugh and also roll your eyes and it hurts a little bit because it was such a terrible joke, it also plays.
What's the ideal setting for telling a dad joke?
Oh, any given moment. The world needs more dad jokes, Gina.
You don't think it's on vacation? I kind of feel like it's on vacation.
All of the above.
James Stutzman, thank you for joining us, and good luck tonight as a competitor and judge in your dad jokes contest.
Thanks, Gina.
It's at a release party for the new beer, Dad Jokes, at City Barrel from 7 to 9 tonight if you want to check it out and maybe tell a joke. That's a wrap for today's show. You can catch anything you might have missed later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. And tomorrow, a mural painting festival will be happening on outdoor walls all over town this weekend. We'll be talking about the seeming explosion of murals in our city on Central Standard tomorrow. So join us for that conversation and talk to us anytime on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. We know it was a heated discussion about micro apartments earlier in the show, and you can keep having that discussion. Keep having your voice heard at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rao, Salisa Kalakal, Chris Young, Anne Knigendorf, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.